So my name is Hong Chin. I'm from Princeton. And so the talk, the presentation I want to give today is called the Introduction to Geometric Geokinetics. So I will explain what it means later on. So I would like to thank Dr. Pasud and Dr. Saloom and the Fields Institute for inviting me here. And I also thank Professor Tan and Davidson back in Princeton for their support of my work. And of course, this is supported by the U.S. Department of Energy. So the outline. So first, I think I will go through the Vlasov equation, then the geokinetic theory, and then I will talk about the geometry of particle dynamics. Basically, I will tell you the geometry of it. So I will tell you the one form and its vortex field, and then the coordinate transformation and the Lie perturbation method that we use. And then we end up with a guiding center, one form. I will explain what it means, but just this is outline. And then I will tell you about the pullback transformation in the phase space. What it means and how it is related to the kinetic theory. And then I will talk about physics, the guiding center and general center, then conclusion. Today I hope I can stop somewhere, during the first part of this my talk, I can stop somewhere here, so I will pick up the rest of them tomorrow. So Vlasov Maxwell equation. I think you've seen this before. But I don't know the background of the audience. So this is basically a Boltzmann equation without collision. And then the difference is here, you see the acceleration force, E plus V cross B. That's not zero. That means it's not free streaming as we discussed for the neutral gas yesterday. And particles, the velocity is constantly changing. Of course, you can write it in this divergence free form, which has some implications, but not too much for today's relevance. So just remember the first equation. So I wrote it in a relativistic form. So for the later, but I guess most people know special relativities. So the electrical field E and the magnetic field B there actually is coupled back to the distribution function through the Maxwell equation. So basically, the electrical field and the magnetic field are determined self-consistently from the Maxwell equation. So that's why it's more complicated compared with the neutral gas Boltzmann equation. You see the integral here. Do they have a pointer or something? Okay, thanks. So the integral here basically is so-called velocity integral. So the purpose of this velocity integral here is not to close the equation into a fluid equation, but instead to get the, this is basically the current you're trying to get. And this is the density which is needed for the Poisson equation. So, and you see, the Vlasov equation itself is a linear in terms of F. In terms of F, it's a linear. Actually, it's indeed a linear. But the E and the B themselves depend on F. So if you look at the Vlasov Maxwell equation as a whole, a complete system, it's really nonlinear. It's very nonlinear. And it has this kind of thing in it, this integral. So it's an integral differential equation, as people call it. And indeed, mathematically speaking, this equation is not well posed, but that's not today's topic either. You can actually, in terms of PDE, study of PDE, the existence of solution, the uniqueness, and the stabilities, actually none of the, you can give a special Cauchy problem or whatever problem, you can prove this three properties is not satisfied. But that's, but of course, in certain conditions, they do. But that's not what I want to speak I think there is a book on that by some Australian mathematician on this. So that's velocity of Maxwell equation. Okay, so forget about the Maxwell equation first. If you just look at the velocity equation with the E and the B, if you look at the characteristics of that PDE, in a magnetized plasma, the characteristics of the velocity equation are highly oscillatory. It looks like this. See, obviously there are two scale of two time scale here. Of course, the high frequency oscillation is caused by the fast gyro motion due to the strong magnetic field. So if the field is very strong, the particle to the first order, they actually rotate. Then they do whatever they want to do later. So you see this larger scale variation, long scale variation is built on top of a small scale oscillation due to the strong magnetic field. So the goal of the so-called geokinetic theory is basically trying to average these high frequency motion out. So that's basically the goal. But I put the quotation mark here. So this average out concept actually is not quite accurate. So I will basically replace this concept later on. But the basic idea is trying to average them out. So the geokinetic theory is important, or it will be realized to be important. Not fully right now, but I think in the future you will realize. Because many interesting phenomena have a characteristic period much longer than the gyro period. For example, this long scale motion. A lot of waves you know, like Arfon wave, a static wave, or Wister wave, any wave you heard about, a lot of them, I would say half of them, more than half of them actually are very low frequency, a long time period. And most of our current understanding of magnetized plasma has been developed using implicitly the correct, semi-correct, or incorrect form of a geokinetic theory. So I can give you some example. Take a classical textbook. You will see they actually somehow use a semi-correct version of the geokinetic theory, like Stick's book. You see Tom Stick's book on wave. If you look at how he derived the dielectric tensor, or the dispersion relation, you will find out actually he used the geokinetic implicitly, but not absolutely correct. And also the other motivation is what Professor Tan talked about yesterday. If you want to do a particle simulation, and if you're interested in the phenomena which has low frequency, like Arfon wave, and you want to use time step comparable to Arfon wave, which is much, much longer than the gyro frequency, gyro period. So if you do that kind of simulation, if you use time step of your interest, you are very likely to be unstable. The numerical simulation scheme is very unstable, because the smallest time scale in the physical system has a time period much shorter than that. So this basically gives you numerical instability if you don't use time steps shorter than the gyro period. But most of the time, you cannot afford to use such a small time step. It's just a waste of a lot of time. And if the equation you simulate at the very beginning do not have this high frequency physics in it, then you actually can be stable numerically. So that's another motivation. That's basically the motivation actually start the whole modern movement of geokinetic theory. Okay, so how do we average them out? Well, the first thing is to find out what's the physics quantity corresponding to the fast motion. Then you average that thing out, right? So you can identify the physics quantity that is responsible for this gyro motion is basically the gyro phase. As Dr. Basud talked about yesterday, the gyro phase is basically the angle of your velocity in the plane perpendicular to magnetic field. This is theta. See, this you have B field there, right? And apart to the leading order particle just do the gyro motion, then this angle basically describes this gyro motion. So if you find this out, you say, oh, okay, so this is the guy actually responsible for the whole thing. then why don't you average them out? Right? Do this. Take your velocity equation with Maxwell equation again, so they are coupled together, and do this gel phase averaging. Sounds reasonable. Then you basically achieve your goal. It looks reasonable, but really it doesn't work. If you want a rigorous version of the theory. So why doesn't this straightforward averaging technique work? Because there are terms like this, v dot partial f partial x. This is the second term in the velocity equation. This term of f is here. See, if you try to average the whole thing, and the v depends on gel phase, because that's basically the angle of v, and so is f, because f depends on v, right? So you got two of them depend on gel phase. If you average them out, like this kind of term, and this term too, basically it's very hard, it's very difficult to calculate. The best you can do is do a free component of each one of them and keep a finite, I mean, keep many terms as you like. But that just looks actually very, not very beautiful. It's not neat. And well, indeed, that's how the old gyrokinetic is. That's like in the 60s or 50s, people just do that. They put a lot of assumption in it, a lot of approximation trying to do this kind of thing, which is very hard, very difficult to calculate. So the modern method that I'm going to talk about is to look at the options of coordinates for the space where the velocity of Maxwell equation resides in, and find a set of coordinates where the gel motion, which the theta, or c, is decoupled from the rest of the particle dynamics. Well, this sounds very abstract, like a little bit philosophical, but I will explain what it means later. So mathematically, we're using the tool of the differential geometry. Well, there is nothing to be afraid of, because the modern theoretical physics has been using differential geometry. Basically, that's their language. That's their tool of trade. And the string theory and everything, basically differential geometry. So hence the name of geometric geokinetics. okay, so that's a brief introduction. So the space. The space where for the velocity of equation. So if you look at the velocity equation, you have x, t, p. I put a TP here. So this actually, because Albert Einstein will tell you that the real physical space is a four-dimensional space-time, right? Then the phase space corresponding to this four-dimensional space-time is actually eight-dimensional, I call it phase space of space-time. So indeed, this term never appears, but for the theoretical purpose, it's better to put it here. So it's basically, we're talking about eight-dimensional space, which is basically the phase space of Albert Einstein's space-time. The velocity equation is just this. Okay, so df here, I wrote it in a differential form. So basically, maybe most of mathematics majors, they should know this. Df basically is nothing but just say, and plus all the x and so this thing is basically a differential form. They operate on the vectors. So the vector is the v I represent here. So basically. So when this, for example, when this dx operates on x dot, you end up with x dot. Just replace this by x dot. When this dv operates on the vector, they took the p component and you replace it by the p component. So that's basically what it is, right? So it's a, so and the T, you replace it by the T component. So when they operate on the on a vector, so that then this thing become a whole they call scalar, which means a real function. So in the this is basically coordinate independent form, because this, see, you can write it have the same form in any coordinate. But this is just tell you in the phase space of space time, the velocity equation is nothing but a simple have this simple form. And now what determines the vector field? Basically, the vector field itself is basically so-called particle word line, which is basically the trajectory in the phase space. As time moves on, the particle execute as what kind of motion, and that thing end up give you a trajectory in the space-time. Theoretically speaking, it should be a simple question, because we don't have too much to work with. We don't have any structure right now, except two things. One is so-called the four momentum, P, in the special relativity. P is basically your classical momentum plus energy, right? And also the four potential A, vector potential. This is basically the three potential plus the phi, the electrical potential plus the magnetic potential. So you only have these two things to work with. So these two things actually can, basically the simplest construction is to add them together. And this is basically nothing, and this thing, you see the same structure in the quantum mechanics. This is basically, tells you how the generalized Schrodinger equation is. But classically this also works. I will tell you why. So, okay, now you have this construction. Basic it's a one form, basically. Or you call it, in a classical physics sense, you call it a covariant vector. So you have two kinds of vector. One is a contravariant, one is a covariant. The contravariant one is like velocity, that's the vector we normally mean. The covariant one is basically the tensor, which is a one form in the modern language. Okay, now the vector, the V, the vector field V, that's so-called a contravariant. And this one form actually can operate on B. But indeed, the particle's trajectory is given by this equation. Okay, what's D gamma? If you have one form, you take the so-called exterior derivative, you get two form. Two form means, what is two form? Two form basically is a 0-2 tensor. Two form basically is a function of, linear function of two vectors. If you give me two vectors, this two form will basically map these two vectors into a real number. Okay, so now this is d gamma is two form. This two form operates, supposed to operate on two vectors. But if you only give a v, then you end up with one form, because right now you need another vector to make this thing into a scalar. So this is basically a one form equation. Okay, so I'm telling you the equation of particles dynamics is given by this equation, very simple form. This is actually the general form of Hamiltonian equation you can write. So it's very simple, only three letters. You see. Okay. Now the question is, does this kind of V exist for the non-trivial V vector V exist? You can actually prove it does exist. I think I will skip this. Maybe they boil it down to this fact. If you have a seven-dimensional, odd-dimensional anti-symmetric tensor, the determinant of that anti-symmetric tensor in an odd-dimensional space is zero. And basically, I will skip this. Just tell you this thing exists after all. That's basically, let me remind you what I've been going through. So one form is basically a 0-1 tensor, which map any TM is basically tangent space. This is basically all vectors. Map any vectors into a real value. So that's basically the definition of template. And two-form basically is anti-symmetric zero-two tensor, which maps any pair of vector into real number, right? Then the pullback and push forward I will talk about later when we need it. Okay, so let's go back to the non-relativistic limit as a special case of that thing I wrote. So P4 is basically just energy. What's P4? Can I write it here so everybody can see? So P, as I alluded, P basically equal P1, yes, dx1, right, plus P2, dx2, plus P3, d32. Now, I say this is a four potential, you know, in a relativistic sense. The third one basically is, so this is minus ET. So this minus is basically Albert Einstein's contribution, right? So the so-called metric tensor for the special relativity is G, or I, G, or, you know, right. So that's the same sign minus sign here. So this thing basically is the energy, like this. In the classical limit, you just do an expansion at a small beta, a small v over c. You get this thing. So that's the classical kinetic energy we know, the half of mv squared. And this is just constant, which you can just zoom out. Why? Because I will tell you why later. But anyway, throw this out because it's a constant. You got this thing. Okay. This is A. You have A and phi. That's the four vector potential. And you have V because from the first three part, you have V and you have half of your energy. I absorb all the dimension into the particle themselves. If you see what it is, this is basically the classical Lagrangian, right? But I write it in differential form. And maybe you have wondered why the Lagrangian is the potential energy minus kinetic energy, or kinetic energy minus potential energy. Why the minus sign? It's not the plus. The minus sign actually came from this minus sign, right? That's the minus sign in a special relativity. But that's not new. I think Hamilton is the guy who found this Lagrangian. Hamilton knows this minus sign. But to what degree does that imply that Hamilton knows special relativity? We don't know. Maybe I personally believe there, to a large degree, or you probably need extra construction that you can derive special relativity from the Hamiltonian, from the Lagrangian, which Hamilton himself discovered. But that's not today's topic. But I just want to know, this sign is very interesting. Okay, so now let's go back to our goal. Our goal is to find a set of coordinate system. X is so-called guiding center. U is basically a parallel velocity. Mu is the magnetic moment. Theta, which is basically the perpendicular velocity. And this C is basically gel phase, where the gel phase is decoupled from the rest of dynamics. What do I mean? I mean, if you look at, suppose this is your coordinate for the phase space that we need for the velocity equation. Okay. Which is basically described by this gamma 1, a gamma. From this gamma, you know, that equation I wrote, d gamma operate on the vector equals 0. From this equation I wrote, you can figure out what the v is. Basically, that's the dynamics of particle's position, dynamics of particle. So basically it tells you this is V, basically. X star is a V, mu star is V in the phase space. And you want none of this thing depend on the jar phase. So notice this guide itself, the dynamics of the jar phase itself doesn't depend on jar phase. So actually you expect this thing. Actually, you expect this thing is nothing but the jar frequency, right? The time derivative of the jar phase is how fast the jar phase moves. Basically, is the jar frequency, which is basically E cross E. You know, I wrote it in the omega. So omega basically is nothing but jar frequency, EBM. C or maybe there is C, I don't know. So basically it's just a magnetic field. How fast this move, you know, this is high school physics, right? How far the particle moves is basically how strong the magnetic field is. This thing doesn't depend on jar phase itself. Okay, suppose you find a set of coordinates like this. So why this is good? Why we need this? Now you write your velocity equation in this coordinate. That's basically what it is, right? The df over that thing equals 0. In this set of coordinate, yes, thank you. In this set of coordinate, you see, this thing doesn't depend on jar phase. This doesn't either. None of them depend on jar phase, right? Now, if you stick in the so-called jar phase average, suppose you want to stick in the big average sign here. And now you can actually, now you can put this average sign onto the F directly. Because the thing doesn't, the coefficient doesn't depend on jar phase. So you end up with, rigorously, this thing plus right, because this thing doesn't depend on jar phase. You put this average sign directly in. Same thing for you. Mu. This is a rigorous equation. What? And when you average this thing, the last term you get zero, exactly zero. Because this thing doesn't depend on jar phase. And this thing's the derivative of F, you get exactly zero. So this is the exact equation you get. No approximation. Of course, later on you'll find this thing equals zero, but that's not important here. But the important is that once you find this coordinate, this kind of coordinate, you actually get your geokinetic, rigorous version of geokinetics directly. So what is geokinetics? So it's not time average over jar period. And it's not jar phase average either. Well, it is, but that's a trivial version of it. And of course, it's not a spatial average over jar radius. Now, what it is, it is basically, it contains no more and no less physics than the velocity of Maxwell equations in the magnetized limit. It is just the velocity of Maxwell equation cast in a special set of coordinates that you construct. So it's all about the quest of good coordinates. That's a very important point. So I'll show you this cartoon. This is a peanut. This is a very famous cartoon in the US called the Peanut. This dog's name is Snoopy, right? Maybe in Canada it's not that famous, but so this Snoopy says, I hope I'm going the right way. As long as I stay south of the 40th parallel and west of 120th meridian, I think I'm all right. But then the question is, somebody should have the meridians marked along the ground somewhere. So it's about a coordinate. It's all about a coordinate. So I think okay, I'm not the first guy who quote this this cartoon, but I think this is very to the point. This is all about. I can tell you more about the Hamiltonian dynamics. That, as I said, this thing. Oh, I just erased this. Sorry. Oh no. Here. This thing is the most generalized Hamiltonian you can write. And from here you can go. Okay, for example, okay. From here you can get this form. So mathematically, if you read all the mathematics book, they will tell you Hamiltonian dynamics is given by a symplectic structure, which is basically anti-symmetric two-form, and satisfy this condition. But this is not the most general case that physics would know. So I would rather pose it, the Hamiltonian dynamics as simple as the one I just wrote there. I think if I have time, I can go back to this. This implies a lot of things, like Liouville theorem, and this is a bit of Stokes' lemma, and a lot of things. But that's not very much to the point of today. Okay, let me review what we've been through. So we have a one form gamma, which describes the dynamics, and we want to find a coordinate for this gamma, which has that good properties. So how do we do this? Basically, we do this by transform coordinate perturbatively in the strong magnetic limits. So this is based on the observation that in the strong magnetic limits, this gamma is this gamma has a coordinate which has that good property. So the unperturbed case basically is given by this. I will tell you the definition for B and the U and the W later. So believe me, this is a unperturbed case. This is a uniform magnetic field case where this gamma, you can very easily construct a coordinate that had that property. Now, when the B field is not homogeneous, you have a small perturbation on top of that. So you basically do a perturbative analysis to remove that inhomogeneity and to construct a new coordinate perturbatively, which has that good property. So what it says is the leading order gamma doesn't depend on Jarre phase. That's true. The first order gamma introduced the Jarre phase dependence, which needs to be transformed away by our coordinate transformation. There are a couple of questions. First, how do I get this gamma 1 first? How do I get gamma 2? I will tell you later. But the point is, once you found the gamma 1 and the gamma 0, how do you do your job? How do you cook a new coordinate which has the good property? Then you basically, okay, again, this is simple differential geometry concept. You do a what is coordinate transformation? So, what is a coordinate? A coordinate is basically a map between the space you have. Suppose this is your phase space. You want to have a map which maps every point on the phase space onto a Cartesian coordinate, basically R6. And you can have a different map for the same point, right? Not big deal. And for the same point, the two maps actually are corresponding to each other, right? Because they are corresponding to the same point on the phase space. And this correspondence between the two coordinates on R6 is basically coordinate transformation, because they corresponding to the same point. And so that's basically a coordinate transformation from X to X bar, which is a map in the R6 space. So once you have this coordinate transformation, because you want to transform your gamma 1. How does gamma 1 transform, right? Suppose you have this thing. How does the gamma 1 transform? And then if you know how the gamma 1 transforms, then you know the answer. But again, so that's what it means. It transforms as a one form. How does the one form transform? One form transforms so-called a covariant. Covariant means it transforms like function itself. So basically, it's pulled back in their terminology. What's the pullback? Suppose you have a coordinate transformation like this from x to x bar. So a function on x bar corresponds to a function on x. How? Suppose you have function capital X on x bar, right? And you have a coordinate transformation t. From these two identities, you have f on capital F on the X bar, on the X bar, and a coordinate transformation from these two property, or from these two identity, you can construct a new function on X. From these two identity, you can construct a new function on X. How? Like, you write this. So this tx is basically x bar. But if you look at this thing itself, it is function on x. Right? So therefore you have from these two function on x bar and the coordinate transformation, you automatically have a function on x. That's what I mean by pullback. It's more like your coordinate transformation go this way, and the function goes back, like there is a function there corresponding to a function here on the original space. So that's how the one form transforms. That's a transformation. But then there is a so-called perturbation measure. Perturbation is basically what it means is if that coordinate transformation is a very small transformation, that means if it's a near identity, then this transformation has some property that you can use. It's simplified. That's perturbation, near identity transformation. So what we do now is we assume this coordinate transformation we are trying to get is generated by a flow, a vector, on the R6. So it's a vector generated the coordinate transformation, near identity transformation. So how does a vector transform a one form? The vector, of course, is basically a vector field generates a flow. That flow transforms your coordinate, therefore pull back your one form. But how does the vector transform your one form? Basically, this is given by this. It's put back, and you can use this formula. This is discovered by Cartan many years ago. It's called magic formula. Basically, what it says is the lead derivative of one form, or any form, equals the inner product of V and the exterior derivative of the vector, of the one form, plus the exterior derivative of the inner product. So what's the inner product? I apologize, I use different notation. So this is basically an inner product. This is basically a definition of it. Basically, it's just operate this two form on the one form to get another one form. So this is definition of the inner product. So basically what this is, this d alpha operates on V, get one form, and this alpha operator on V get a vector, get a scalar. But then you take the exterior derivative, you get another one form. Okay, that's how the vector, how the one form transforms under the a vector. And So and so this is the new gamma 1 bar. That's a transformed one form equals the original one plus the small perturbation you introduced. That's it. And you can actually, this term is the term that I haven't discussed about yet. You can add an arbitrary term like this here. This S1 is so-called gate. It's arbitrary. Why? Because the whole thing matters is with the dynamics itself is d gamma. The dynamics is d gamma. So as long as the d gamma is the same, what gamma you pick, it doesn't matter. So the reason you can put arbitrary gauge there is because ds equals zero. So basically that's a, this basically says, I think that's what it is, right? This basically says the gradient field of a scalar is curve-free, right? So the same construction. So you can add in any function as you like to simplify your coordinate construction. So that's basically how you do it. Okay, now we go back to gamma 1 and the gamma 0. Since we have know how to deal with gamma 1, so we go back to the question, how do you find a gamma 0 and a gamma 1 first? Then you transform it. I think Dr. Besson talked about this yesterday. So take NAV. B is the unit vector along the magnetic field direction. So there is a unique split of the V once you give in the B into the parallel part and the perpendicular part. Right? So this is the first equation is uniquely defined by the magnetic field. Of course, if there is no magnetic field, the whole thing doesn't work. So we're talking about strong magnetic field limits. There must be a magnetic field. And this X, this construction is basically defined the capital X. Basically it says the small x equals capital X plus a so therefore the big X is basically so-called guiding center. The small x is the particle's position. Basically, suppose this is your magnetic field. This is your B. And so this is the capital X. This is small x. This is where particle is. And so this is the row. Basically now, see, the essence here is that we're trying to define the so-called guiding center here. And we hope, the hope is this guiding center doesn't depend on geophase, right? Because as the thing rotates, the guiding center doesn't move. So that's basically the purpose of the construction here. Then, after you've done this, see, this construction defined kept vector A, which is basically in the direction of the row, the jaw radius. So this is uniquely defined. Then you write your gamma in this coordinate using for the spatial coordinate you use the capital X. For the velocity coordinate you use this parallel velocity U, perpendicular velocity W. You need another one, right? Because there's three dimensional velocity space. That thing is a geophase. It basically measures your velocity direction in the perpendicular direction. This is basically, you need some measurement of this angle. So there is a question mark here. To measure this angle, you need the starting point, right? I mean, relative to who you measure this angle. So you actually need a coordinate frame, B, E1, E2. So E1, E2 is a frame set in the perpendicular direction. And it's totally arbitrary. It's up to you how you measure it. So that's actually another gauge. Basically, it's a gauge, whether it's a gauge theory, as theoretical physicists talk about, that's a question, Mark. But it's like a gauge that you pick, how you measure the gel phase. It's totally up to you how you measure it. And your physics result shouldn't depend on this pick of arbitrary gauge. And use this coordinate, you found is gamma zero, like this form. I actually wrote this before. And if you look at this thing, see, none of the coefficient depend on the gel phase. That's a good one, because that's the one we are trying to get. Therefore, when you output this thing on the vector, see, those things replaced by the, say, C dot, and this thing replaced by X dot, and this replaced by T dot, then none of them depend on the gel phase. Then you're good. But the gamma 1 does depend on gel phase. So the small parameter, actually I haven't told you, I mean I skipped, is basically the inhomogeneity of the magnetic field and the non-constants of the magnetic field. You assume they are, this is a small parameter. Also, you assume electrical field is small, but you don't need to, but for today's purpose, I assume it's small. So you treat them as perturbation. So when the small parameter is not zero, you find you have a first order gamma 1, like this. It's quite complicated. It takes a while to work this out. You see, A and B, I wrote it in the index form. As I say, B doesn't depend on gel phase because that's just a measure of your magnetic field direction. It has nothing to do with the particles of velocity. But A does, right? A is basically the gel radius. And so is C. C is basically the velocity direction in the perpendicular plane. So both A and C, they depend on gel phase. Oh, sorry. Yes. And therefore, and most of them depend on gel phase. Therefore, your gamma 1 is the bad one. I think I wrote it wrong. This knob shouldn't be there. The dynamics of gamma 1 is gel phase dependent. Oh, it's not gel phase independent, sorry. So that means it's a gel phase dependent. So again, so we use the coordinate transformation technique that I described to get a new one. Try to transform this way. Construct a vector field in R6. When that vector field operates on this gamma 1, you get a good gamma 1, right? Okay, after many pages of derivation, that's what you get. You get a gamma 1 like this. Again, this X and W and U, they're not the old one anymore. They're the new one. I'm using sloppy notation. They should all have a bar in it. But, yeah, but just let you know. So they should all have a bar in it. Then the new coordinate, I mean, in the new coordinate, this gamma 1 does not depend on gel phase. Well, of course, and that's a question. A actually depends on gel phase. So is C. But the truth is, this combination, they don't. Yeah. Yeah, how did I do that, right? What's that? How I did that, okay. You basically construct a vector, I think that's my fault. So, that's a coordinate transformation. And you assume this coordinate transformation is generated by a vector. Vector field G, and given a vector field G, you have a new transformed for any given G. You have a new transformed gamma 1, right? This vector is six-dimensional. Therefore, you have a lot of freedom to pick that G. So you pick the G, which actually transforms the theta dependence away. And of course, you need to know the expression of the transformed gamma 1 under G, right? So that you can pick terms. Once you know the expression, you pick terms that depend on theta and construct a bigger G which cancels out that jaw phase. So that's basically, yes. I skipped this thing because it's a lot of algebra. But in the process, you basically have to do this. So that's the formula. So this is unperturbed gamma 1, which is a bad one. And this is a transformed gamma 1. And this 1 actually is, I should write G1. That's just a G, a vector field you have, like this, operate on the unperturbed leading order. See, so this is the first order, because the G you pick is small, it's near identity. And you can have an arbitrary gauge here. And this is the new gamma 1 you would have. So the purpose is, this one has a bad element in it. So you want also use the G here, G1 here, so that the G1 you pick in this part, as well as S1 part. You can pick S1 too, any S1, cancels out the bad element here. So that's basically it. I think my time is up. Maybe 5 minutes. I think I would just okay. Yeah, that's pretty good actually. I'm right on time. So once you do that, you end up with something like this. Here's the point: A and C depend on theta, but this combination doesn't. You can verify that by yourself. So overall, you add them together. First, to the first order, and this is a good one. This is where the Java phase is decoupled. This is like what I call guiding center 1-4. Actually, I haven't told you about the coordinate transformation itself. It's very complicated. Well, I tell you how to do it, but I didn't write it down. Because that's the vector G. That's what the G generate. Once you have this thing, you can write your velocity equation in this new coordinate. But the coordinate transformation is important itself, because that's how you get those things. Of course, the velocity equation itself doesn't depend on how you transform. Once you get it, you can just write it in this new coordinate. It looks like you don't need this transformation at all, right? That's not right, because we haven't talked about the Maxwell equation yet. If you look at the Maxwell equation, if you want to get it correct, you really need this coordinate transformation itself. You do need to get the right Maxwell equation. Why? Because the Maxwell equation depends on this kind of integration, right? And also, this Maxwell equation sitting on the laboratory frame, this Maxwell equation doesn't sit on the capital X. Not the guiding center frame that we construct. If you think what capital X is, it's a combination of a small x and the velocity, right? The definition of guiding center depends on how fast the particle moves. The smaller the particle moves, the larger the jaw radius. Therefore, the further away the guiding center. So the guiding center itself is not a pure coordinate for your configuration space at all. So that's one thing that a lot of a geokinetic theory, actually, they get a lot of them get it wrong at this point. So that's not where you can write your Maxwell equation at all. So besides, you need that velocity integral too. So now we have to go backward to look at what a kinetic theory really is. So kinetic theory deals with particle distribution, right? On the phase space. Basically, P is phase space. for every phase space point, kinetic theory the distribution function tell you a real value of its distribution property, a probability. Kinetic theory actually implicitly makes use of the fact that the phase space is cotangent bundle of configuration space. What I mean is, what the current version of kinetic theory assumes that for every configuration space x, small x, you have a velocity at each x you build onto another space on top of it. Let me finish this point and then. So when you say fx v, you mean for every point on the configuration space, you can expand this point into a 3D velocity space. Then when you do the velocity integral, say, if you want to get the density, you get the density at this point, right? So this set of coordinates is very special. In a sense, it's a very special set of coordinates for the phase space. So nobody actually, if you think phase space as a space itself, nobody prevents you from using this coordinate. For example, can I use this one, x plus v? I can use this coordinate. I can construct a new coordinate to basically mix these two up, right? Because this is two independent one. And if you mix them up, suppose you call this, that's basically what we do here. We call this guiding center. And you call this whatever. And can you just do this? You don't get that. Because, you know, it's not right. So in our case, we roughly did this. And we keep this fixed. We keep this still V. Even that, this is not the so-called configuration space at all. It's configuration plus the velocity. If you do this, you don't get this this density at that point, right? So the so-called the current version of kinetic theory actually assumes the coordinate itself is basically is a fiber coordinate, as I said, or they call it cotangent bundle. That's basically what it means. At every x you build on top of it, but if you pick a coordinate, we mix them up. This coordinate may be not useful for the n, for the say density at configuration space and the velocity. Same thing for velocity. So that's the problem. So that's where the pullback transformation is needed. So that's where I'm going to talk about next time to basically tell you how do you resolve this problem. Yeah.